Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We transmit on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. Online, that's bcfmradio.com. This week, the Swiss bank guard who discovered UBS, who he was working for, were destroying records of bank accounts of Holocaust victims and pocketing their money, plus lots of other people who died. Also, Maurice Kirk returns, the flying vet. This time he's back from Africa. And Moeen Yassin is one of the people behind London's new Islamic business channel. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft just off Jamaica Street on 0117 909 6897, online at prsc.org.uk. Also online, you can go to the volunteering website do-it.org, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Christoph Meili, and I worked as a security guard. And before, I worked as a salesperson my whole life, computers and all that. But because my wife was sick, I changed the job to security, and I was able to work different shifts, so I had time to be at home, take care for the kids. And why I landed there, it just they needed UBS that time, the headquarters in Zurich. They needed additional guards, and they hired, or actually they rented guards out from a security company. So I was one of the best they had, and they put me there.
Okay, so this security company, you weren't directly working for Union Bank of Switzerland in Zurich.
No,
you were working via an agency. So who was the agency?
The agency was Wache AG. And Wache AG, or translated Watch AG, they sent me there for 1.5 years.
Okay, so you actually were came across a whole bunch of documents that were being prepared to be shredded, and tell us why these documents were so important.
Well, it was all about a complete banking history about four different Swiss banks: Swiss National Bank, then of course UBS, then Eidgenössische Bank, a pre bank before UBS. And it was all about, it started in 1864, going all the way up to 1976. And it was original ledgers, accounting books, very important stuff. So
now, that's a long period of time. It's about 110 years, something like that. So what was in all these documents, and what made you think, maybe these shouldn't be shredded?
Well, in that time, they rebuilt the bank. Actually, that's why I was there. I was additional staff for protection security, the workers, controlling the workers, giving them entrance and stuff like that. And so they redone the locker complex. They have a 3-story underground locker complex. You can rent boxes. You can also rent whole offices. And they have clients they paid for 100 years. Nobody knows what is inside. So, and they cleaned some of them out. And I was thinking they throwing this away. And so I was interested, when they throw it away, why not just keep it or take something with me? I can, for historical reason, you know.
I mean, I suppose the most interesting aspect of this is that some of the documents related to money which had been deposited in Swiss banks by people who had subsequently either been sent to concentration camps or otherwise been killed during the Second World War. And now one does wonder with banks whether, say, for example, someone deposits, say, £100,000 or dollars or Swiss francs in a bank and then dies, what then happens to that money?
Well, what the Swiss did, they cleaned that out. But also there were Jewish lawyers, too, that cleaned that stuff out and left behind maybe 50 bucks, you know.
So what was the Swiss bank's attitude when somebody deposited money and then died?
Well, what happened is most of the time they say that you need a death certificate. And the problem was with a lot of survivors, Holocaust survivors, they didn't have a death certificate of their parents or whatever that they lost in Auschwitz or whatever. And the Swiss banks then said, well, without death certificate, you cannot have access to their money. So they denied or even denied the existence of any account.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, Christoph, the only person who may know about such an account may be the person who's now dead. So I wonder how much you estimate, now you've had a bit of time to reflect on this, how much you estimate that the banks had taken from these various dead people. I'm not just talking about Holocaust survivors or people who died during the Holocaust, but also you know, anybody that's deposited money there and subsequently died. How much money have they taken from these people?
Well, it's actually a huge amount of money. We're talking about not only Holocaust survivors, we're also talking about the whole industry, the industry that was in Germany, IG Farben, which was managed by Eidgenössische Bank. And they cashed in on that. And it's not only people, it's also industries.
Well, that's amazing also because IG Farben in its day in the 1930s and 40s was actually the biggest combine in the whole of Europe. So right. Anyway, so what was the consequences? Because I understand that there were some court actions based on some of the documents that you rescued.
Well, actually what I found was IG Farben documents. I found their stocks deposited in Eidgenössische Bank, which was then becoming UBS after World War II. And they restarted their business in 1952 and hiding in Switzerland. And so it's huge, it's big. Even it's like that the Swiss finance families have chosen Hitler. Hitler was created, he was chosen, that this is the guy they're going to use and support. In 1923, Hitler came to Switzerland, and he was a nobody. And the Swiss industrial families and finance families, they decided to use him, and they given him a lot of money, and then also supported his criminal friends, industrial friends, to rebuild the German industrial war machine. So we're talking about huge amounts of money. What I have seen is just the money that they sent over to Germany after Hitler was in Switzerland in 1923. It was millions of Swiss francs. Today it would be billions, you know.
Today, we're told by whistleblowers such as Scott Bennett from the U.S. Army that Swiss banks are also being used as a secret way of financing groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS via countries like Kuwait, through Saudi Arabia, these kinds of organizations, and through intelligence services. Do you think that's credible?
Yes, I think it's credible. They have the network, the finances. When I worked at UBS, UBS has their own network, UBNet. And over UBNet, I was able to call any telephone line in the world for free, of course, and just go out in their local, like in your local community, I go out and have a local call to somebody, but I go over UBNet. And therefore, I wouldn't have to pay international fees, you know, international calling fees. So they have their own networks to do these things, telephones, money transfers, whatever you want.
It does sound to me like there isn't any proper regulation, and I wonder if you're also, I mean, because it's the central bankers, central bank in Basel in Switzerland, where all the central bankers meet, the Bank for International Settlements.
Yeah, that's BITS, yes. BITS, yes.
And so, I mean, it seems to be a money center for the whole world. But, I mean, do you think there's any credibility to the allegations that there's actually a fantastic amount of wealth squirreled away in these bank vaults and under the mountains in Switzerland?
Yes, I do. Yes. BITS was founded to support, and in World War One, they supported both sides, the Germans and the French, and then they cashed in. And the same bank was used in World War Two to manage Germany. And even today, it's there's no police guy can go into that bank. It's off limits. And it's owned by private Jewish families. They also own the Federal Reserve in America, and they're all Swiss and Swiss Jewish families, Rothschilds. They're German actually, Rothschilds, Loeb. They're in Swiss, and Moscovich. You know. The finance families. And since 200 years, they started with Napoleon, since 200 years they control the world through money creation, money printing. And they use the BITS or the Federal Reserve in Washington to control every country in the world. But the headquarters is in Switzerland.
So what would you say to anybody who's maybe a bit skeptical about how powerful the Swiss still are? Because, I mean, we think of the Swiss as being very reasonable, very clean, very tidy, well-organized, and not really interested in war at all.
Well, they let other people do wars. They have white gloves, and they have their corporations and their outsource corporations that do the wars. Like right now, it's America that they use to manage all these wars around the world. But America is just in the same footstep that the Germans were. The Germans were used. They were used to rob Europe, but the money was then deposited in the Swiss banks.
And are you glad that you took those documents from UBS, however long it was, about 10 years ago? Are you glad you did it?
Yes, yeah, I was. It's okay. Yeah. It was a little bit shining light into the inner workings of this Swiss finance families that actually goes back to the colonial families, you know, that did all kinds of stuff.
Which colonial families?
Well, it's the no ones, you know, the Rothschilds, you know, Rothschilds. And all that stuff.
Okay.
They had the slave trade and all that, you know. And there are many colonial families that are still living, and their children, and they're living in Switzerland, Luxembourg, France, you know.
Okay, Christoph, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Yeah, no problem.
rejected. You're the junkie, and I inject it into your bloodstream. It's like a bad dream. Money's the fiend. Do you know what I mean?
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, I'm joined by Maurice Kirk again. Maurice, you're in here every few months, keeping us up to date with your activities, usually in the air. Now, let's just start by recapping. I think, am I right in saying you have flown under the Severn Bridge and the Clifton Suspension Bridge?
No, I'm reserving one of those. I've done one, but I'm reserving the other until I'm old and tired.
Okay, so what, you've done the Severn Bridge. I would imagine that's a bit easier and safer, is it?
Well, I waited. I was in the air squadron at Bristol University at Filton Airfield, and I think 67 or 66. And there was the section in the centre, and we were all waiting for it to be put into place. And I thought, yes, before anybody else does it, I've got to do it. In an RAF marked orange RAF chipmunk, which was a training.
They are noisy aeroplanes, aren't they, the chipmunks?
I don't know. I've got a lovely photograph. In November, I remember turning her over on her back and taking a photograph with some old Voigtlander Bellows camera. I think it was Dad's. And I took a photograph of the sunset on a November evening from upstream of the bridge. And I actually found that photograph recently. Brought back wonderful memories.
I mean, is it silly of me to say that it's more dangerous to fly underneath the Clifton Suspension Bridge than it would be the Severn Bridge? Because the Severn Bridge, the original one anyway, is a bigger gap to fly through. Is it that simple?
Sadly, it is, yes.
Has anyone flown under the Clifton Suspension Bridge? I'd imagine.
Yes. I think a Hawker Hunter went under there.
Did it survive?
Oh, yes. You know, it was a bit like, because you know I used to ride motorbikes seriously. I remember the meeting, I think it was Joey Dunlop, on the races in the Isle of Man. And I remember he was being interviewed and he said, how can you do those speeds at the fastest straight at the top end of the Isle of Man? And he said, well, I used to just... everything got fuzzy at 140 or 50. And he said, as long as I just pointed the bike between the green bits. Well, it's a bit like that with, I would imagine, flying down through. But I'm in a very slow aeroplane. But the Hawker Hunter, which I've flown, would have been going through there at 300 miles an hour, 400 miles an hour. Which concentrates the mind.
How slow do you fly? I mean, you know, you're mostly... What's the your aircraft you're normally in?
Well, my public hub on the way down through to Kenya... on the way to Cape Town at the moment. Being a wartime airplane designed to take messages between General Patton's tanks in the Falaise War, the Falaise Battle, and from then onwards up through to Paris, up through to Berlin, the airplane was specifically designed with big tyres and to land slowly.
Why didn't they use radios?
Use what?
Radios to communicate.
You'd think they had those things in those days that
yes.
were reliable and they could... No, they're taking messages. They're taking packages, parcels between the battalions.
Also, I suppose, if you're talking on the radios,
radio... The radios. Yeah. I mean, come on.
They'd be intercepted, wouldn't it?
Well, no, they didn't know how to intercept in those days. They were real... They were crystal sets for a start because I had a wartime aeroplane, an old Oster, and I remember when I first got married in 1970... Was it 71? September. I remember we flew down through to Spain in this old wartime aeroplane, an autocrat. And when I got to Bordeaux, I paid £750 for this aeroplane, an awful lot of money. And I didn't have the frequency, so I had to climb over the back of the aeroplane with Janet trying to keep the aeroplane straight and level. And with these crystals, which were quite big... I had to change the crystals for receive and transmit. So that's two crystals for talking to one airfield. And quite a dodgy
maneuver. You can just sort of turn a little knob and tune it.
No, because you had to tune around between your legs underneath your feet to get it to work accurately. But if you only had six channels. So me and Janet flying down to Spain... we needed at least 10. And
wouldn't she have preferred to go on the ship rather than go down like that? Sounds a little bit dangerous, Boris.
Well, Janet married me, which says it all, doesn't it?
Okay, so you mentioned briefly there your trip to Africa. You actually made it into the news again. I mean, you did, I think the last time we spoke, we mentioned the little hiccup. In the Caribbean, and George W. Bush, you landing in George W. Bush's estate afterwards, and to thank him, and then managing to get arrested. But this was down in Sudan, and you were lost. Well, obviously, you knew where you were. What happened?
In Texas, yes, I was deported in chains around my ankles to Gatwick, and they escorted me all the way to Gatwick. No, South Sudan. Wow, I'm. Wow, what an experience. I think some pilots call it, I ran out of height and airspeed and ideas all at the same time. But I actually was suffering from malaria, cerebral malaria, and there are various types, but this was a killer, quick killer one. And as if things weren't bad enough. But anyway, I can't tell the story until... time has gone by because it really is quite exciting and close on the line of legality. So I can't really tell you, but what I can say is that when the aircraft or the remains of the aircraft in the back of a 3-ton truck travelled from the South Sudan in the middle of the war with guns going off all around me when I landed into Nairobi... the guys there at the oldest air club in the world, the Aero Club of East Africa, they said, well, we've seen it all. Morris, we've seen a few pilots come through Africa on the way to Cape Town, but you are the first to fly into South Sudan in the middle of a war without a visa and come out without getting shot.
So is that what, I mean, is that what you were in the Sunday papers? I seem to remember. They just said you and I think maybe another aviator had actually got lost in Sudan, but you were actually being rescued.
I wasn't rescued by anybody, and I wasn't lost, but I can't tell you really what I was up to other than to say, because you know me, that I couldn't really go past South Sudan without having a look around what the Aussies called walkabout.
Now, the reason you went on this trip, and where did you start from?
Oh, the Quantock Hills in Somerset.
So you actually flew down to the north of Africa and then down, because I think the race started Crete.
It wasn't a race, it was...
Sorry, all right.
It was vintage aeroplanes, one or two modern spam cans, you know, these tin things. But I started in Hestercombe House, Mike Gange's field, where I camped for 2 months in a tent, building the aeroplane for specifications to get to Cape Town. And it was very sad to leave there. But I set off and down across France to Crete, and I was late because they'd asked me to produce the aeroplane at Horse Guards Parade beforehand for some sort of showmanship thing, and I had to take the wings off, didn't I? And I got up there, and then I had to spend the night, so I parked my aircraft on the Mall, as one does, and spent the night in my car. But because I took the wings off, the paperwork involved in British airspace made me at least 3 or 4 days late, which is why from then onwards, when I got to Crete, I was 3 days behind them all the time.
Well, it's lucky it wasn't a race then.
Well, I caught up with them at Khartoum.
And what's it like flying through Africa? Is it still a bit difficult to get the right place to land, to get fueled up and all that sort of thing?
Well, the flying is the same as anywhere else in the world. It's when you land. I landed in Sudan and they wouldn't have caught me. I mean, no one would have heard anything about me, but I had a puncture. And this D-Day Piper Cub had never had a puncture in her life. And it's because I had a puncture that the authorities caught up with me.
So did you have to get the puncture repaired or a new tyre or what?
Well, I can't say it was repaired because of the regulations within aviation. But we sorted it.
Did you go via Gibraltar? Did you go right across the Mediterranean?
Well, that's the way I was going.
Right.
Because I wanted to go down to Cape Town via Gibraltar and keep rumour has it I keep getting lost. I mean, on the way to Australia, on the way to Japan, across Texas. I mean, people have suggested I just keep getting lost. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be lovely to go down easily without having to relax, get upset about navigation, and go to Gibraltar, which is an absolute must for an Englishman like me, and just keep the water on the right-hand side and get down to Cape Town. But then I heard about this group of old biplanes.
So you're talking about flying down the west coast of Africa.
Yeah, but then people told me that the climate was horrible for an old man like me. And then I heard about this group of aviators in vintage aeroplanes, biplanes mainly. And I thought, hang on, that's coinciding. And I cut a deal.
So how long does it take to fly from Crete to Cape Town?
I have no idea. I haven't done it yet. I'm currently in Nairobi. The engine is in pieces at one airfield at Wilson Airport. And the airframe is in, I can't pronounce the airfield, patiently waiting for me to return. I'm up to my neck in paperwork. But I will get to Cape Town in due course.
Oh, so a little bit of a pause in that trip. Right. I'm not sure if the paperwork will still be valid by the time you manage to get to Cape Town.
Well, that's anyway, what I'm worried about.
You've been doing also your court case in South Wales with South Wales Police. That's been chugging along. Have you had anything positive?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Let's just refresh on what that was about, because as I understand it, you correct me if I'm wrong here, is you kept being stopped day after day after day by the South Wales Police, wanting to see your driving licence, your insurance documents, MOT,
yes,
this sort of thing. To such an extent, it was quite clearly some kind of harassment, and you decided to take them to court. So
that's right.
How's that case going?
I decided to do that 25 years ago. I mean, I'm on the tail of Jarndyce and Jarndyce of Bleak House. Well, I think a few generations took place before the families ran out of money, and when they did win the court case, there was no money left because the rogues, I think they call them lawyers, stole a lot. Well, I'm going down the same sort of route because I decided to sue them because I kept winning in court. And the first action was 33 incidents where I had malicious prosecutions, and I kept winning them. Well, I won all of them. And so I decided enough is enough. To get them off my back, I will take them to the Cardiff Civil Justice Centre in Cardiff. Unfortunately, I didn't know that different rules and regulations operate and morals operate in South Wales to where I come from in the West Country. That was my big mistake. But anyway, that's water under the bridge. But recently, Her Ladyship, the Recorder of Cardiff, Ellery Rees, who knows me well because I think I have been before her, I got that the right way around, several times over the last year. I mean, I was before her first for trading in machine guns, and I was asking to get bail from the prison in 2009, and by gad, the lady nearly did it because she knew immediately that it was a stitch-up by the South Wales Police to interfere with my civil damages claim that was about to go to trial with about 150 witnesses. And, Her Ladyship was before me. Sorry, I was before her 2 or 3 weeks ago. Mr. Kirk, you can have the transcripts of any case that's been before the court here within my jurisdiction, which is her jurisdiction. And I thought, I won't get them because, of course, they've redacted and removed and actually altered court records because I've been to jail now nearly 3 years in my life in Cardiff Jail, Swansea Jail, you name a jail in Wales, and I've been there. In fact, I could even write the Rone guide to the cuisine, because being a favourite subject of mine. And this last week, I put it on my website, morrisjohnkirkwordpress.com, which is now designated to expose what goes on in South Wales courts, law courts, that I'm going to get, some people believe, the transcripts where the psychiatric doctor, i.e. the forensic psychiatrist for Wales, no need to mention his name, went before the court and said, Morris Kirk has irreversible brain damage. We believe he has a brain tumour. He should be locked away in Ashworth High Security Hospital indefinitely. And the prosecutor said to the judge, Judge Neil Bidder QC, and by the way, the prosecutor, wash your mouth out, Morris, was called Richard Tomlow, and he said, yes, Mr. Kirk has been diagnosed with a brain tumour. Well, I was registered MAPA Level 3, Category 3, which is the top 5% most dangerous people in the country, and I was in prison waiting for a machine gun case. Well, that transcript went on without me. They wouldn't let me in court. So I've only got the tail end of it. But now Her Ladyship, 2 weeks ago, has said, you will have all of it. Well, this big machine, news. This big progress.
Well, this machine gun case, what were you doing with trading machine guns?
Oh, well, I mean, that's another nonsense, of course, because they've all closed ranks, the civil judges, Crown Court judges, civil judges, and I'm now suing the South Wales Police for malicious prosecution because the machine gun case was on the 25th, 26th of January 2010. I'd been in prison for nearly 7 months, and everybody knew I was going to win it, and they wanted me to use a local lawyer because if I used a local lawyer, my defence would be leaked back to the prosecution. I wasn't going to fall for that one. And also, they're notorious in South Wales for putting plants on juries. And sure enough, there was a plant on my machine gun jury, because when I won the case, which was not very difficult, I didn't call witnesses or give any evidence. I saw no point. I was walking down the first act released after 7 months, walking down the centre, and nine of the jury were in the pub. And a beautiful little girl came out, blonde, put her arms around me. Morris, come and join us. And I said, Madam, I've been locked up in Cardiff prison for 7 months. I'm dangerous. I'm really, with a pretty girl like her, and potentially dangerous, I think I should say. And she said, oh, no, the jury are here.
Let's just get back to this whole business of the machine gun. Am I right in thinking this machine gun was off an old World War One aeroplane?
Well, it's all Bristol. I was an old friend of Brian Trubshaw, the test pilot of Concorde, that was designed and built on Filton when I was learning to fly at Bristol University in 1964, 65, 66. And he rang me up 20, 30 years later and asked me to fly my replica First World War biplane with a machine gun on the front, which was a replica First World War Lewis machine gun, the most successful machine gun of the First World War. And it actually got used in the Second World War because it was so reliable. And the South Wales Police dreamed up a way of stopping my civil damages from progressing by having me jailed and getting me sectioned under the Mental Health Act for having a machine gun. The books of the aeroplane were sitting on the prosecutor, Richard Tomolo, desk, and I remember my son Casper watching from the gallery. The minute I thought, well, it's time to finish this case, we've had a bit of fun for a few days, let's look in the books of the paper of the aircraft to see that it's legally registered as part of the airframe. And Casper describes how he watched the prosecutor quickly pushing the logbook for the airframe and engines pushed under paper so that nobody would know where they were. But anyway, the jury sussed them in the first day.
Well, that's good news. Do you think you're going to get anywhere with the South Wales Police? I mean, because at the end of the day...
Well, they can't afford it.
I mean, at the end of the day... you really would like, I would imagine, some money from them, compensation of some sort, and
No, I want those who are responsible for having me locked up for years to be jailed, and I want them to nullify the fabrication of convictions, the very few convictions, that they then they contacted the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons on the 6th of January 2000, making a complaint. And that led to my name being removed from the veterinary register. I now have a lawyer who is prepared to act for me at the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons, and we intend to beat them. Money doesn't come into it anymore. They've lost my health, wealth, wife, and qualifications. You can't put money to any of that. And I'm 72 years old. And they are dragging out this litigation to make sure that I'm stopping breathing before I beat the little blighters.
OK, Morris, well, more power to your elbow. Good luck to you on your next adventure, whether it's down to South Africa or to the Cardiff courts. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Moin Yassin from Global Vision 2000, the UK-based independent Islamic think tank. And on the holy night of the ascension to the heavens on Monday, April 24, I'm pleased that Global Vision launched our new website and initiative called the Islamic Business Channel.
The Islamic Business Channel, I suppose many people in Britain will probably have some idea of what, kind of ethical business might mean here in the UK. So, for example, I know Methodists and Quakers, people like this in Britain, would always, before they opened their business meetings, they would have a time of prayer before that business meeting started. Of course, that happens very, very rarely nowadays. I mean, we've got almost all our corporations. Everybody will sit down and they'll just start immediately talking money and what is the latest development on the first thing on the agenda, maybe looking at the minutes of the last meeting or something like that with no prayers at all. So tell us a bit about what Islamic business means.
Well, the Islamic business is quite profound, actually. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a new concept, but it would be rooted in the values of Islamic finance and economy. And I think that's where the main problem is in the Muslim camp.
Well, that's interesting because also the Christian values, traditional British values from hundreds of years ago, would have been, as Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, previous Archbishop, pointed out, that the laws, the Sharia law of Islam, was actually really similar to the Christian laws when it came to things like business deals, i.e., for example, no charging of interest in the past in Britain. That, of course, was all overturned when it came to the English Civil War and the creation of the Bank of England, these kinds of things, scrapped all that. So am I right in thinking that in the Islamic world, many of these values, which were here in Britain hundreds of years ago, are still preserved?
Yes and no. The reality is the Islamic civilization is in a crisis due to the legacy of internal and external factors, including what we call globalization, the reinvention of neocolonialism and imperialism with globalization. So it is actually fitting into a Western non-Muslim value system of finance, banking, business and power. Now, unless we have the bigger picture of what's going on, we won't understand what we're trying to do here. I did mention there are a lot of shared values east-west, you know, in this world, despite people who want to make walls, barriers and clashes. You know, there are universal values of justice, truth, integrity, justice. But the current one of my slogans for the Business Channel is moving towards a universal paradigm shift. There are underlying values in business of trust, ethics, social justice, growth, equality, community. However, capitalism and communism, I believe, have undermined them. And I believe that the world is painfully going through a transition to a new world. I call it the century of the five C's. It's nothing new. When I created Global Vision, I was studying satellite TV, internet, the lot. Then as a non-technical guy, and I had this vision of the century of the five C's. Unfortunately, very soon after 2000, we had 9/11. So anyway, I believe this is the century of the five C's.
I understand that you've got some spiritual guidance in the Islamic Business Channel from someone called Imam Ali. Who is he?
Well, yes, that was in my press release because... See, what we're doing is quite profound at a time in Britain and Europe where some of the values that they represent are being denigrated. And I've really strived from day one of Global Vision to now, taking it to a different level. I'm trying to focus on what is the Sharia, especially on universal economic values. Why economic values? Because I think that is the key weakness in the Western economic, financial, economic, banking business model. It has already collapsed. Indeed, Islamic wealth underwrites the toilet paper fiat currency. Why do we call the dollar the petrodollar? It's because Muslim wealth, basically the petroleum, underwrites the bankrupt paper currency, which upholds the Venstrean post Bretton Woods financial banking system. So I'm homing in not the puritanical reactionary interpretation of Islam, like about controlling women, dress, etc., etc. I'm focusing on what does the Sharia and Islamic values, what are they really about? They are ultimately about social economic justice for the world. And I would humbly submit that is one reason why Islamic civilization has been demonized. Because underpinning the banking financial model, nothing wrong with making money, but not money at any cost in Islamic civilization. But the key critique we have about Western capitalism is that money is a commodity. And the way money has been made a commodity is through having a price, namely interest, compound interest. Now, the bottom line of compound interest is slavery. The slavery of the individual, the economy, and the society. So we are promoting a very full-blooded vision of no, as far as possible, of an authentic interpretation of Islamic finance. Currently, the global Islamic finance movement has been, if not hijacked, has been compromised as a subcategory of Western debt-based financial usurious capitalism.
So you see a paradigm shift happening. Where do you see that paradigm shift happening? I think many people around the world think that the system as it is, particularly in the West, and particularly relating to war and money, is not working. So where is this paradigm shift? Where can we look for it?
You've put me on a spot. I think no country currently in the world has got this paradigm shift. Unfortunately, I think humans, East, West, Muslim, non-Muslims, are going to learn the painful way. And the painful way is we're going through one bust of the capitalist system. You know, it has cycles of boom and bust. Think, unfortunately, the current system is going to have other bubbles bursting, and that will force the situation globally. People will be forced, societies will be forced to take a new direction for banking.
So, I mean, is there any way that people can prepare? Is there any way that people can prepare for this financial crash?
Well, in a sense, that is the purpose. I haven't made it explicit, but I've said as much as I can on the press release. It is a preparation, yes. And that's why we're working with actual, not just thinkers. We've moved away from a think tank to companies and organizations. For instance, BBX, a global trade exchange which connects businesses based on surplus capacity, but also interest-free credit. Also, the platform, the virtual platform, people have got to start connecting beyond race, religion, ethnicity, and geography through communities of collaboration. The technology is there.
And whereabouts can we find the Islamic Business Channel online then?
Well, we spend resources, money, and collaborations with other companies. It's on our new website at globalvision2000.com. And interestingly, I might as well say to you tonight, as we were getting it live, it was hacked, but we will install by a Turkish hacker and playing Islamic music, but we'll have it up live soon again.
Oh dear.
But with stronger, what you call, IT security measures.
Okay. Moeen Yassin, thank you very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download that MP3 from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests. That was Christoph Miley, the Swiss bank guard who discovered UBS were destroying records of the bank accounts of Holocaust victims and pocketing all their dosh. Also thanks to Morris Kirk, just back from Africa, and Moeen Yassin, who you just heard from there, London's new business channel for Islam, the Islamic Business Channel. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk online. Also, you can go to the do-it.org. That's the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
The spatial streams, but the lake is steep and the light is dark. Still, I see him leap, and he keeps on heading for a star that's not very far. He's traveling on a silver filigree. I've been waiting at the eastern gate. I wave my hand to flag him down. I always hope to catch him, but he just can't wait. He's not allowed to reach the ground, but his touch can heal when the light is dark.
doesn't need a shield, 'cause he keeps on heading for a star that's not very far. He likes it all just because it's real. Though I'm sitting in the grit and grime, a spark of hope is in me strong. I'm gonna try to get there in the nick of time, and maybe I can ride along if I have no fear. When the light is dark, I can feel you near. Though you keep on hitting for a star that's not very far, please don't forget if your way is clear. I'll be waiting here, doo 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 doo.